From the late 1990s until very recently, James Risen was a national intelligence reporter for the New York Times, a Pulitzer-winning sleuth who focused his sleuthing mainly on the CIA. Maybe his most famous story, reported along with colleague Eric Lischblau, revealing the George W. Bush administration's massive wireless surveillance program, is one the New York Times waited 13 months to run. It was also a story with extraordinary ramifications for the public, the law, the security state, the practice of journalism, and Risen's own life. But that narrative cannot be separated from events that preceded it, from tectonic geopolitical ones to Risen's pesky habit of unearthing embarrassing secrets. In a recent piece in The Intercept, where he now works, Risen revisits the conflict, the intrigue, the lies, the institutional failures surrounding that 2005 bombshell, and the fraught but occasionally symbiotic relationship between the secret keepers and the secret revealers. It's a cautionary tale and a complicated one, worth exploring in depth, so we called Risen last week and asked him to begin at the beginning, and that begins with the ritual tantrums from spy agencies and the Congress in the wake of any big intelligence scoop.
The government would not really ever crack down on leaks. They would announce that they were really upset about a story, or they would call you and get really angry and yell at you.
There certainly weren't big prosecutions. Leak investigators went through the motions, and inquiries never really went anywhere.
I think in exchange, there was an understanding in the press that when there was a sensitive story that involved highly classified information, the editors and the reporters would go to the government and get their comment. And then if the government had concerns about certain parts of those stories, the editors and the reporters were willing to negotiate with the government on what to keep out and what to print.
And that informal, mutually beneficial arrangement served him well. For a time, over the years, Risen got some really big scoops, in part because of an accident of history that made it the perfect time to start covering the CIA. He happened to join the beat just after the Cold War ended, when the agency was downsizing and reeling from the devastation of a Soviet mole caught in its midst, namely Aldrich Ames.
Ames sold the names of every double agent he knew of, causing the deaths of at least a dozen. The CIA knew it had a traitor, but didn't catch Ames for 9 years.
Aldrich Ames and his wife Maria are still, of course, the alleged spies, but there is no doubt in Washington tonight that this is an intelligence disaster.
The Aldrich Ames case led to a lot of recriminations within the CIA over how that case had been handled. And that led to even more people leaving. And then the Clinton administration began cutting the budget of the intelligence community as part of the peace dividend from the end of the Cold War. And so it was like a whole generation of senior CIA people decided to leave. One person who was part of that exodus told me it was like an airline lost all of their senior pilots all at the same time. And a lot of them wanted to talk. You know, they'd never really talked to reporters before. And what I found was that once you talked to some of them and then you wrote stories that they felt were fair and accurate, that they would, you know, recommend other people talk to you. And so it quickly developed. And as I said, it was also this time when there was not this crackdown on leaks. So in a lot of ways, it was the best time to cover the CIA.
So your Rolodex fattened up right nice.
Yeah. And so that really worked well for me by the time in 9/11, when the coverage of intelligence and terrorism became much more intense.
All right. Now, before 9/11, something else happened that I think very much informed your approach to covering the intelligence agencies. And that was the arrest of a scientist, Wen-Ho Lee, who was accused of spying for China. You covered that, and it was a mess. In what way was it a mess?
Well, the government's case against him ultimately collapsed, And I think the judge in the case apologized to him on behalf of the government for the way his case had been handled. And the New York Times, we had taken the lead in the coverage, and we were heavily criticized for my coverage. And there was even an editor's note in the paper saying that we had been basically too pro-government in the way we had handled it. And I believe, looking back now, that the criticism was valid. It really made me much more skeptical of the government.
All right, so some lessons learned, but then comes 9/11, followed by the run-up to the war in Iraq. And, the big story those days centered around Judy Miller's reporting that made the case, or at least passed along the case, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which was the linchpin of the Bush administration's argument for war.
There is just a limit to what the United States can do. Now, what it probably shouldn't have done is ignored the situation as long as it has. But now I think the United States understands the stakes fully well.
And this was an episode also for which the Times eventually apologized. But you don't really see that as a Judy Miller being gullible problem. It's a deeper one.
Yeah, I think it was virtually every media organization in the country was involved in publishing and broadcasting stories purporting to show the existence of weapons of mass destruction. Judy, I think, has become a scapegoat for the rest of the media who wants to forget their own involvement in covering WMD, including places like NPR and public television and every news organization that I know. I think it became very easy for everyone to kind of focus on Judy in order to forget their own involvement. As a result, I think very few lessons have been learned in the press about what happened. No one wants to admit their own involvement, and so no one has learned the lessons.
Well, Judy fits into your narrative in another way, which we'll get to in a moment. But I'm curious to know what you were thinking, having lived through the Wen Ho Lee debacle and having been burned by it, what you were thinking as you read these pretty uncritical pieces about uranium tubes and yellow cake, all these other stories that she was fed by the administration was dutifully passing along. Were you suspicious of those at the time?
Well, I was trying to get my own stories into the paper that were skeptical of the pre-war intelligence. And what happened was that my stories were getting cut and buried and held. The paper was obviously not interested in kind of the skeptical approach of my stories. And it was very difficult to get greater skeptical stories into the paper. And one of the few that I was able to get on page one was a story about how the famous supposed meeting between Iraqi intelligence and al-Qaeda operatives in Prague hadn't happened, and that it was not a real meeting, despite the way that the Bush administration at that time was using it as justification for war. And my editor told me that he felt like he had to run it on a Monday when no one else was around to contradict him about putting it on page one.
Oh, you mean because the Sunday staff, the senior editors weren't there?
Right. I was fighting to get these stories in, and it made me very depressed and frustrated that skeptical stories that I was trying to write were not getting into the paper.
Now, apologies to listeners, because this gets a little complicated. But there was another story you got that figures very much into the James Risen narrative. And that has to do with a CIA operation. The idea of it was to get Russian nuclear warhead blueprints and to alter them in a way that would have made any warhead built from them inoperable, and to get them in the hands of Iran so that they spin their wheels building a nuclear missile warhead that will never work. Tell me about the story and what its consequences were.
Well, the story was that the CIA had a nuclear blueprints, but and that they were going to be embedded with flaws. The problem was that they were going to give these to a Russian who would then hand them to the Iranians to try to get them to, go down the wrong path of building a bomb. The problem was the Russian told the Americans immediately he could see the flaws and that they were obvious and that the Iranians would see them too. And thus it would be kind of a botched operation in which the Iranians could take the accurate information from the blueprints and ignore the flaws because they were put in so obviously.
Counterproductive counterintelligence.
Yeah. And the Americans kind of ignored that and went ahead with the mission.
And you got the story, and the Times goes, oh my gosh, this is so great. It's so significant. We're putting this on the front page today.
Well, that's not quite what happened. I called the CIA for comment, and then immediately Condoleezza Rice, who was then the National Security Advisor, called the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times, Jill Abramson, and demanded a meeting. And Jill and I went to the White House, I think the next day, and we met with Condoleezza Rice and George Tenet, the CIA director. She kind of stared at me from across the room and demanded that I never make another phone call about this story and destroy my notes and never do anything more with this and that the time should spike the story because it was so important. And she said, you know, I remember her saying, you guys criticize us for going to war on WMD, but this is what we could do instead. And Jill and I left the meeting kind of stunned by the full court press. But I also realized we had just gotten amazing confirmation of the story from both the director of the CIA and the National Security Advisor. You know, after a while, I began pushing to get the story in the paper. And the problem was that this was happening at almost the exact moment that the Jason Blair scandal was happening at the New York Times.
All right. This was the reporter who was caught plagiarizing and also inventing from whole cloth stories that had been on page one and everywhere else at the Times. It was a mess. And the very credibility of the Times was being questioned every single day because it had printed so many lies. And it was a horrible egg on the face for Blair, for his patron, Hal Raines.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that cost Raines was forced out as editor. And then there was an interim editor, and then there was a new executive editor by the summer, Bill Keller. And so ultimately, by the time he came in the summer of 2003, I met with him and talked to him about this story and tried to get him to publish it. And he decided not to, based on the national security arguments of the government.
Now, this was the spiked story that kept on giving, because it would become central to your life for a number of years. But I want to pause just to reflect on this notion that when the government says, as it often does, that various kinds of journalism compromise national security, that it is of the essence that they never see the light of day because lives will be lost and our borders will be vulnerable. Did you believe it?
No, because after 9/11, the Bush administration had been doing this very regularly, and the Times had been killing a number of other stories that I had done. And I was really beginning to get very frustrated. Frankly, I didn't believe them anymore about their arguments. They kept saying it about things that obviously were just embarrassing to them. One of the stories that I had in 2002 that they killed was just the existence of secret prisons by the CIA. The first secret prison had been set up in Thailand after 9/11, where they were holding Al-Qaeda operatives. And the government got us to kill that story. And I realized it was just because of the embarrassment of the existence of these secret prisons. I began to think that, as you say, they just cried wolf all the time to avoid political damage or embarrassment. I think there's a real difference between political embarrassment and national security damage. And I think that's the problem that all these stories have, is they are politically damaging to the government. And so they use national security justification to try to kill stories.
Yeah, politically embarrassing and sometimes actually criminal. But look, your bosses at the Times aren't stupid, and they're not inexperienced. So why were they so more willing than you to be deferential? Why were they so much less skeptical of the government's arguments in this story and others?
I've thought a lot about that, and I think part of it is that I was living this on a daily basis as the reporter covering national security and intelligence. And so I saw this firsthand all the time. You know, this happened over a period of several years with several different editors, and I think that I was more experienced in dealing with these issues, and they were up close and personal for me all the time as part of my job. And the editors would just come in and out, you know, when the government would call them. I don't think they had, you know, the same level of involvement with the issues that I did. I would be the one talking to sources who would tell me about these things. I was the one hearing the other side of why these things should be published. And the editors were only hearing really from the government, even though I would tell them why we should run a story.
We will return to the Iran Blueprints case again, because it had such an impact on your life and career. But for a moment, I want to get to the next story that you were working on with your colleague, Eric Lischblau. You got it in 2004, and it was about a covert NSA warrantless eavesdropping program. Absolutely illegal. You found out about that, as did Lischblau, independently, and you worked on it together, and then what happened?
Well, I should say that what we found was that this is the NSA domestic spying program that is the largest counterterrorism program of the post-9/11 age. It's the basics and the outline of the domestic spying program that Edward Snowden later released documents on to provide greater detail on. It was the same program that Snowden's documents relate to. What we found was that they were not only listening to American phone conversations and reading the content of emails, but they were vacuuming up millions of people's email addresses and phone logs and email logs. The beginning of a massive domestic spying program. As soon as we found out about this from various sources, I finally decided to talk to the director of the NSA and go through, you know, do what you call as a reporter, go through the front door. And I called the NSA's press person and kind of bluffed her, said, I need to speak to the director immediately. To my shock, the director, Michael Hayden, got on the phone and was sitting at my desk, and Lischblau was sitting right next to me, and I just started reading Hayden the top of the draft of our story. And after, like, I read two paragraphs, he just goes, and then he says, he kind of stumbled with his words and said, well, whatever we're doing is legal and operationally effective. And then he kind of got off the phone. And I realized that he basically confirmed our story. So I went to see the Washington bureau chief, told him. Then pretty soon after that, Hayden called him, told him that the Times shouldn't run this story. And that was the beginning of over a year's worth of negotiations between the Times and the government over whether to run the story. This was all secret, stayed secret for over a year. And it wasn't just the NSA, it was the whole Bush administration. Our first meeting after that phone call was at the White House with the acting CIA director and his chief of staff. And then there were other meetings over the next year, many of them with the very top of the Bush administration, culminating in a meeting between President Bush and Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times.
Now, there were a lot of things going on. One of them was that the NSA was telling a series of lies. I mean, in spite of Hayden's de facto confirmation, they did everything they could to diminish the significance of the operation.
They argued a lot of different things at different points. Ultimately, as you say, at some point they started arguing that Eric and I had misunderstood the program and that they weren't actually listening to the content of phone calls or reading the content of emails.
That it was just metadata.
Yeah, and they only told that to the editors. So Eric and I were not there when they were saying that. And so it took us a while to realize that the government was misleading the editors. And when we realized that, then we finally were able to convince them that they were being misled by the government. And then we also began to get sources who told us that there were people high up in the Bush administration who were afraid that they might be prosecuted if the existence of this program became public, and the fact that it was illegal would lead to their prosecution. And that also gave the lie to the argument that the many people in the government had been giving to the editors, which was that the program was perfectly legal and fully vetted. And so those two things began finally, you know, after the end of the year to convince the editors that they should run the story.
Now, the editor who finally pulled the trigger on this was Bill Keller, but not till 13 months had elapsed.
Right.
And, you know, he's not a wallflower. What was his argument for not publishing?
Well, I think he has said, and I interviewed him for this piece, and then he has also said elsewhere that he felt that, you know, a big factor for him was the sense that, you know, 9/11 had just happened three years earlier when we first had this story, which was 2004.
Here is CBS's Leslie Stahl asking Bill Keller about this very conflict.
Do you think that they were more worried about losing this tool to fight terrorism, or that they would be embarrassed by it because it was spying on Americans?
I think both of those things concerned them. But it was a question of, if we publish this story, will it, to put it bluntly, cost lives?
Did they argue that it would cost lives?
Yes. There's also a context. I mean, it was not that long after 9/11, and I think all of us were affected by that.
We had this meeting on the story between him and me and Eric Lischblau and all the other editors involved maybe a week or two before the 2004 presidential election. And we were pushing to get the story in the paper. And most of the meeting was about the kind of this debate between civil liberties and national security. And the focus of the debate was about really whether the program was legal or not legal, and whether that was the kind of the tipping point for whether it should be published or not. I argued that it was in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, which required the government to go to a secret court set up by that law to get search warrants for national security wiretaps on Americans.
Not to mention the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution.
Right, right. And that was what sources were telling me. And the government's view, you know, won that day. Right after the election of 2004, Eric Lischblau and I pushed them to let us try again and try to get it into the paper again. They said, go ahead. And so we did more reporting and more rewriting. You know, we went to the editors again in December 2004, and again they killed it and said basically for the same reasons, that the government said it was too valuable and that the story would harm national security.
Now, there's another consideration that was not mentioned by Bill Keller, and that is something else newspapers are loath to do, and that is to print explosive information on the eve of a national election.
Right.
They don't wish to be held responsible for something as important as the election of a president based on a story that may or may not turn out to be accurate.
Right. Well, in the piece, I mentioned how during that same meeting a week or so before the election, it was becoming clear to me that Keller was not convinced and that he was leaning towards killing the story. And so I kind of out of desperation said, well, you know, I think one of our key sources will go elsewhere with the story if we don't run it before the election. And I can remember as soon as I said that, I realized that was probably the wrong thing to say. And it turned out it was the wrong thing to say. And Keller really took that as he kind of got his back up and...
Well, because it was a shakedown.
Yeah, right. He said, you know, he didn't want to have it for a political impact. And I said, well, by not running it, you're having a political impact. You're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't.
That line, that one line in your 15,000-word piece was the one that most surprised me. Almost every source, particularly of secrets, has a motive. They very often have lost in a policy fight or something else. They're mad at people or they think the law has been broken or whatever. Yeah, animus is almost the definition of the motivation for a secret source. So why do you suppose that that struck him as a warning sign?
Well, just as you said, we were up against the presidential election and that this was a key moment. And ultimately, I don't think you can say whether or not this impacted the election, but there were a lot of people since then who have thought it did. And if you remember, it looks in hindsight like Bush had a fairly comfortable lead in the election. He actually came down to just Ohio and about 200,000 votes. So anyway, it's one of those great what-ifs in history.
Let us briefly return to the question of how big a pain in the ass you are. You warn the editors that if the Times doesn't print the domestic surveillance blockbuster, that it's going to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And you realize that it was the wrong thing to say because it made Keller mad. But it didn't stop you because your next play was even more explicit blackmail because you were going to put it and the Iran blueprint story in a book.
After they killed the NSA story a second time in December 2004, I was scheduled to take a book leave. I had had lots of stories killed over the last few years. I'd had this experience with the WMD pre-war intelligence coverage where my stories kept getting cut and buried. I was fed up, and I felt like I couldn't cover the war on terror the way I wanted to. I couldn't keep doing this. I couldn't respect myself if I kept letting all of my stories get killed. And especially the NSA story, if it came out later from somebody else and it turned out that people would find out that I knew about it and didn't do anything about it, I would never be able to live that down. And so I put them in my book. It was scheduled to come out in January 2006. When I finished the manuscript, I told the New York Times editors, the NSA and Iran stories are going to be in my book. You should publish them.
You had really painted them into a corner.
That was my checkmate.
And so then what happened?
Well, they thought I was being insubordinate.
Because you were being insubordinate.
And so we had a lot of very tense meetings. They said, we will reconsider running the NSA story, but if we decide not to publish the story, you have to agree to take it out of your book. After going back and forth on that for a while, I finally agreed to it because I realized that was the only way to get them to actually reconsider running the story. But I also knew, which I didn't tell them, I knew it was already too late to take it out of my book. And I wasn't planning to take it out of my book. And so I was essentially gambling my job.
Well, in some ways, all's well that ends well. The Times did run the stories. They had the predicted effect.
So we want to find out how you feel about domestic spying. Do you support it or do you oppose it? The numbers are on the screen.
The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy. You got to understand, and I hope the American people understand, there is still an enemy that would like to strike the United States of America, and they're very dangerous.
These revelations about the NSA surveillance program, the National Security Agency domestic spying program, I think it's way too early to see that in the polls.
It turned out well, but at the time it looked like it was like two trains running down the track at each other.
Okay, so on the subject of near head-on collisions—
Right.
You had one with the United States government, and this gets back to the Iran's phony blueprint story that finally saw the light of day in your book.
You know, after our NSA story ran, the Bush administration started a leak investigation of the New York Times and the NSA story, and they impaneled a grand jury in federal court in Alexandria to look into that. And then when my book, State of War, came out, they started a second leak investigation into my book. And ultimately, they decided not to go after the New York Times on the NSA story, I think probably because they didn't want a real constitutional showdown with the New York Times. So they instead came after me independently of them on my book. They looked into several chapters, I know that. And they conducted investigations of, I think, at least three different chapters of the book, looking for something. And finally, they decided to do a leak investigation of the chapter that included this botched CIA operation. And then in January 2008, I was subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury to reveal my sources in the chapter in my book that included that.
Now, during this time, you, of course, repeatedly declined to identify your source or sources on this story. They prosecuted a former CIA officer named Jeffrey Sterling. But your own personal exposure to imprisonment didn't end with the Bush administration.
Actually, there were two different grand jury subpoenas, and I was able to avoid testifying based on either one. They subpoenaed me a third time for a trial, and I refused, and the judge quashed that subpoena, and that was under the Obama administration. I thought, okay, that may be the end of this, but they appealed the judge's decision, got her decision quashing the subpoena reversed, and they did it based on their argument, which turned this case into a fundamental constitutional showdown. They argued that there is no such thing as a reporter's privilege, that the Obama administration's position is reporters have no right to protect their sources in criminal cases.
If her original decision had been left to stand by the appeals court, her interpretation that the Constitution did offer journalists a privilege, but the right. Obama administration challenged the ruling, and now the law of the land is that no such constitutional protection for reporters exists. So while you never spent a day in jail, the legacy of this case is rather ominous for reporters.
I became a very vocal critic of the Obama administration's views on press freedom exactly for that reason. And a lot of other people never understood why I was so adamant in my criticism on press freedom issues. And it's because of precisely that. Their brief and their arguments to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, if anyone wants to go back and read what they wrote, are chilling. What they wrote is language that could easily have been written by the Trump administration. Other people in the press kept saying, oh, why does Risen care so much? Why is he making such a big deal out of this? It's because they hadn't really read the positions of the Obama administration.
I say this is the law of the land. In fact, specifically, it is the law of the district that the court has purview over, but that includes where all the national security coverage emanates.
The Fourth Circuit includes Maryland and Virginia, which are home to the Pentagon, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and virtually every other major national security agency in the government. And so it's jurisdiction for almost every leak of classified information in the government. It's the jurisdiction that matters the most when it comes to press freedom in the United States.
All right, Jim, so I'm obliged to ask you this. Your NSA domestic surveillance story got in the paper after a 13-month struggle, so I guess that's a win. Although the story would have emerged anyway with the Edward Snowden leaks.
I don't think he would have ever gone out in public if it hadn't been for our stories initially.
You didn't go to jail, but Sterling did. He's still in prison. And the protection of the press has been legally eroded. And the informal arrangement that we began discussing at the very top of this conversation between the intelligence agencies and the press that enabled this trafficking in classified material has been damaged as well. So I wonder if in the end, as you look back, now that you've kind of unburdened yourself with this cathartic piece in The Intercept, whether you think the victories were real or just kind of pyrrhic?
No, I think it was very real. What I think the legacy of this whole thing was to force the press to go back to a much more aggressive approach to covering the government. And I think that ultimately the battle I had on the NSA story in the New York Times has ushered in a new era at the New York Times of being much more aggressive, especially on national security reporting. And today I know that the paper is much less willing to agree to requests by the government to hold or kill stories. I think it was a really important impact. I'm very proud of what happened. And I think ultimately it was important for the American people to know about a lot of these things that I've reported on.
We're having this conversation on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
As we speak, Congress has rejected legislation that would limit the government's capacity to perform domestic surveillance. What are we to make of that?
Well, you know, in the wake of our stories, Congress was forced to act. Both in 2007 and then in 2008, they passed legislation to deal with what we reported on. And the 2008 law is still in place. It's called the FISA Amendments Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Amendments Act, which updated the FISA law to more or less allow what the Bush administration was doing to be legal. Now, you could argue, well, Bush just got what he wanted once our stories revealed that what he was doing. But what I cared was that the American people would know about it and would be able to debate it and then decide what to do. And that's what journalism does. We forced a public debate. The Congress then debated it and decided how to deal with FISA and how to deal with the laws surrounding domestic surveillance. And they are continuing to do that. They did it again after the Snowden leaks and tweaked the 2008 law. And they are continuing to do small modifications every couple of years to the 2008 bill, that legislation that passed as a result of our stories.
Jim, thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
James Risen is senior national security reporter with The Intercept and director of the Press Freedom Defense Fund there. His recent piece is The Biggest Secret, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. And finally, let me just say, we've been trying to get you on this show since the Truman administration. I am so glad to finally hear your voice. This has been a pleasure.
Oh, great. No, it's great. It's great. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And, you know, as they say in airports, thank you for your service.
That's great.
Take care, man.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. This has been an OTM Podcast Extra. If you like what we do, make sure to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want even more OTM-y goodness, make sure to sign up for our newsletter, which offers a weekly dose of OTM hits, recommended readings, and gems from the archives.